WBAI New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Coming up in just a moment will be equal rights and justice here over commercial-free, listener-supported WBAI.
This is Equal Rights and Justice, where we educate, agitate, and organize to empower we the people, for another world is possible, and we are the ones who can make it so. Homeless people say Mayor Adams' attempt to police away homelessness and sweep individuals out of sight is a page straight from the failed Giuliani playbook, and challenge the lies and misrepresentations about them, and demand a real plan for housing services and supports, not handcuffs and coercion. I am very pleased to have a number of activist theoreticians who are the people who do agitate and organize to empower we the people. Gary He is with us, who is a member and activist with Youth Against Displacement. Tom Angotti is a professor emeritus of urban policy and planning at Hunter College and the Graduate Center, City University of New York. He was the founder and director of the Hunter College Center for Community Planning and Development, and his recent books, all of which are a must-read, are Zoned Out, Race, Displacement, and City Planning in New York City, and New York for Sale, Community Planning Confronts Global Real Estate. Rob Robinson, a good friend of the station, who's co-founder and member of the leadership committee of the Take Back the Land movement and is currently a special advisor at Partners for Dignity and Rights, and Michael Williams, who's spent decades working with runaway and homeless youth support services and has been on the front lines directing and directly working with the homeless and the unstably housed New York City youth, ensuring their voices and concerns are listened to and their needs met. And that's what we're seeking to do today. And good morning to all of you. And I must start off with one extremely good piece of news, which is dear Brittany Griner has been released and should be home shortly. Long overdue and a good way to start this morning. But let's begin, actually. I'd like Rob in particular and Tom and Michael to join in this discussion, and that is, we want to picture the homeless, if you will. And what I mean by that is we've developed this social construct that looks at the homeless as though there's some separate classification of human beings, of tenants, that these are people who are dysfunctional. They are people who have become social pariahs. They are people who are in some ways destructive to the social fabric. So let's debunk some of the mythology. Let's picture the homeless. And I do want to start with Rob Robinson, and he's going to tell us why, or maybe I will. And that is that Rob Robinson was himself homeless for 2 years and is perhaps one of the significant in the world community people who look at the issue of homelessness and really the most fundamental component of that, which is housing as a human right. Rob?
Mimi, good morning, and thank you for bringing us together and bringing me on a radio show with a longtime mentor of mine, Tom Engadi. We have worked together going back to my days as a member of Picture the Homeless, and it's an honor to be here on the radio show. So as I always like to say, a lot of homelessness is about storytelling. And if you want to debunk the myth, you have to share your story. And that's why I've done it for the last 15 years, right? You know, there are people still today that look at me or look at me way back then, 2005, 2006, and said, you're homeless? You don't look homeless. Well, what does a homeless person look like, right? I think so. We develop these narratives that we pick up and run with. I think if people were to look closely at shelter populations, which are somewhere near 60,000 in New York City, many of those folks are municipal employees, transit workers. They're impoverished. Rents rise faster than wages in this country, particularly in the city, and it makes it difficult to find housing. So you have a various mix of people that end up homeless. I would also say some of this dates back to the fiscal crisis in New York City, going back to the 70s in the Abeam administration, when the city washed its hands of responsibility for anybody with mental illness or mental disabilities, right? They just, you know, opened up doors and said, you're not our responsibility, figure it out. So it's a combination of a lot of things that feed into this homelessness background, but I think not addressing poverty in this country is the underlying factor. And the fact that people, we don't recognize in the city or this country, housing is a human right, which means people deserve, for the fact that they're human, a clean, affordable place to live, right? So I think it starts there.
Michael, I want you to add your voice now, because you also deal with another population, if you will, or grouping of people that are subject to homelessness. And I want you to picture that group of homeless too. So again, we can debunk the mythologies and figure out what is to be done about declaring housing a human right legally as well as ideologically.
First of all, thank you so much for having me and having all of us on today to talk about these vital issues. I work as a staff attorney at The Door, which is an organization in New York City that works with young people between 12 and 24 years old. And we see maybe 9,000 to 10,000 young people a year. Of those young people, a large proportion are people of color and immigrants. And we provide multiple services to them. So in the work that I've been doing at The Door, we provide significant services to young people who are either runaway or homeless youth. We have a specific department to provide services. We also provide legal services. And so in that regard, I have to totally back up what Rob said and what you said earlier. There's this pervasive myth of the housed and the unhoused as if they're two different communities. But in the work that I've done at The Door, I'm very, very aware from the young people that I work with of all the different circumstances that lead to young people being homeless, and with the top issue, of course, being the lack of affordable housing. So that when young people are facing challenges, like young people who are LGBTQ, which are a large percentage of the homeless youth in New York City, young people who've been in foster care and have not been able to find stable housing after exiting foster care, failed adoptions, and lots of other circumstances that we can talk about, there's just not easy purchase or available purchase to get housing that's affordable. And so as a society, we're asking young people during particularly the older, minor, young adult age range to figure out education and housing and relationships and sexual identity and all of these other issues during the same period of time, while at the same time they may have, as in many cases for people at The Door, lack of family or other social supports. And particularly lack of financial support, but even people with financial support, how do you afford housing in New York City if you're starting out as a 21, 22, 23-year-old young person and don't have other financial supports available to you?
So, Tom, picking up on what Rob and what Michael were saying, let's take it to the next level. So, generally, where are we when we look at, and anybody can participate in this, please, the more that you interact with each other, the richer our conversation will be. But I'm going back and thinking about Robert Hayes, who was a white shoe lawyer more than 25 years ago, who regularly passed somebody who was homeless in the dead of winter and would have an empathy, a consideration, a sense of humanity, and would give a cup of coffee or a buttered roll or something to buy breakfast. But he still was looking at this person initially as somebody who was pathetic and not in a way of what their humanity was. There was no conversation. There was no real understanding. And then one day, Bob Hayes actually spoke to this gentleman and realized that he had been denied shelter. We won't go into all the reasons that he was homeless to begin with, which we'll discuss in the course of this panel, if you will. But it was the issue of he didn't have housing. It was quite as simple as that. And when he tried to get shelter, he was even denied shelter. And be clear, shelter is different than housing. So I want to look at what is it that we need to do, again, about picture the homeless and how people become homeless. Is it their dysfunctionality? Is it their incompetence? What are the real root issues? And certainly all of you should join in this discussion. But Tom, start us off on that.
Well, there's several roots behind this. And by the way, thanks for inviting me back, Mimi. It's great to be on your show again. part of it is a deeply embedded ideology in that was at the founding of this nation, which is the rough and ready, hardy pioneers are the people who will survive in the wild. And if you don't survive, there's something wrong with you. And so it contributes to this widespread myth of the deserving poor. The deserving poor are the people who work themselves to death. Everybody else is to be left and left alone, and it's their fault. In other words, people who are in dire straits, it's their fault. So that's kind of deeply embedded in the ideology of a nation that was founded by Europeans who came to grab land and accumulate and leave by the wayside anybody who wasn't fortunate enough to secure a place on the land. And so I guess the other thing I would just put on the table is we have this idea that housing is just a problem of the market. It's a problem of supply and demand. And the problem is that there's not enough supply of housing for everybody. In New York City, this is particularly deeply embedded in the politics. So the solution to the housing problem is to build more. Well, this is exactly what landowners and real estate investors love, because the more housing they can create, the more they can have access to land that increases in value when the housing is built. So the constant argument of the real estate has been against rent control, against any regulations that limit the housing market. And they fought rent control, rent regulations for years. And the way to solve the problem of people without housing is to build more housing. This sort of got a big boost during the Reagan administration and the neoliberal era, which is that the myth that only the market can really resolve it. Government's incompetent. So coinciding with Reagan was defunding of public support for public housing and for other forms of subsidies, and conversion to subsidies that essentially made investors and real estate interests wealthy without necessarily solving the housing problem. And so the current situation in New York is dire. The number of people living on the streets has not gone down. It fluctuates, but it's at a high point now. Even after the last several decades, when the real estate industry was heavily subsidized to build more housing, we still have people who are houseless. And government throws up its hands and says, "Okay, good. We need to encourage more private investment. We need to encourage more housing development." But the more housing gets built, and the newest housing in New York City is not for low income working people; it's luxury housing. And guess where the largest percentage of vacancies of housing are? They're in the new luxury housing. So forget the supply side thinking that says we're going to build our way out of this crisis.
Rob Robinson, your thoughts on what Tom has been saying, and then Michael will certainly add your thoughts. And then we're going to also hear from Gary, who can certainly confirm what you're saying, Tom, and is dealing with a particular situation in Chinatown, which threatens to displace a whole community, and with a 45-story, what they're calling jail scraper, a skyscraper that is replacing housing there, and to the cost of billions of dollars. And we'll find out more about that story from Gary. But Rob Robinson, Michael Williams.
Sure. Mimi, I certainly agree with Tom's assessment. As I stated earlier, he's a longtime mentor of mine, and you mentioned two of his most popular books, so I certainly agree with Tom's thinking. But I'd like to go back to your question and the Robin Hayes, because I believe that storytelling needs to be a big part of solving this problem, right? I equate storytelling to collecting data, right? And if we are able to get people out of the from underneath the umbrella of shame around this issue, and they start to share their stories, then trends start to surface because we're collecting data on why people became homeless. I myself, much like Robin Hayes, I see people on the street and I have a conversation. And the reason I have that conversation is in the 2.5 years I spent on the streets of Miami, there were several days I went without eating. So at the very least, I'm going to ask people if you're hungry. And then I start to have a conversation, why are you out here, et cetera. And I notice you start to develop trends and why things are happening. So there are a lot of social implications that apply here, and most notably, people don't have housing, and it's difficult to get in housing. But I think disputing the narratives, the prevailing narratives, and it's what drove me to this work. You're homeless because you don't want to work. You're homeless because you have a chemical or alcohol addiction. You're homeless because you don't have an education. You're homeless because you have mental illness. Well, none of those things apply to me. And I said, I need to go on a storytelling campaign, and I need to encourage others to share their stories. And I think that's how you start to change and bring people with lived experience to the table to participate in the solutions. They have the solutions, not the people that stand behind the scenes, politicians and developers who are all going to figure out this problem. They don't have that experience. You need people who live through this to make the decisions or be part of that decision-making process.
And Michael, you mentioned a particular group of people, young people. Wow, you talked about from between 12 and 24 years, those who age out of foster care and don't have any housing opportunity, those who are runaways because it is too dangerous for them to live their life and have their identity and not be molested, whether it's psychologically or physically in their household. So, I mean, how do you look at this issue of, again, deepening our understanding of who the homeless are, why people are homeless, and what this has to do with the fundamental root of a society that is not providing housing and uses a general categorization now of affordable housing. But, of course, affordable for whom? So that certainly isn't the answer. But your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, very simply, I mean, even just this morning, there was an article in CNN which referenced a study from 2021. Where college students were surveyed nationally, so this isn't just a New York City issue, and 14% of the college students basically identified themselves as homeless. That doesn't mean that they were all out on the streets. In many cases, they may be in temporary housing. They may be couch surfing, going from one friend's house to another repeatedly. This population of young people are young people who are trying to continue their educations, and probably most or all of them are also working at the same time. So just in terms of busting the myth, when people are imagining young people who are homeless, they're not thinking about young people who have educations, who are trying to advance their educations, and who also are working to support themselves as best they can, but simply don't have financial resources to be able to afford housing. And that's a reality around the country, but that's particularly a reality in New York City, that the young people that we work with at the door are challenged by every day, how to juggle all of these needs, how to take care of yourself when you may have been, and certainly without family supports, and at the same time identify a housing situation that's going to be safe and affordable. Sometimes that means someone who is underhoused or unhoused may be very concerned about being in a youth shelter, and they may make other alternative choices to avoid being in a shelter. Sometimes that means that people in a housing situation where they're facing and situations.
Michael, I don't know. Maybe we should try to call you back because your phone is breaking up. Let's just try to see if you can complete that sentence. Otherwise, we're going to call you back because you're breaking up. So let's, if you could just try to complete that sentence, then maybe the problem has gone away. Michael?
The force is it. Yes.
Yeah, your phone was breaking up there. So let's see if you can complete that thought and not break up. Otherwise, we'll just call you back. But let's give it a try.
Okay. Well, you can move on to someone else on the panel for right now.
Well, your phone seems to be okay now. So we will definitely come back and complete that. I want to bring Gary in also. Gary, again, is with Youth Against Displacement. And your own thoughts on this particular dilemma and the issue that you are struggling around with housing and displacement in the Chinatown community, Gary.
Yeah, I want to comment about Rob Robinson's statement about storytelling is an important one. So I want to mention the story that is trying to be told now. Many of you may have heard about the jail project going on in Chinatown. It's going to be a 45-story jail, the tallest jail in the world. And I also want to mention that in Chinatown and the Lower East Side, generations of immigrants and workers built up the Chinatown and Lower East Side we have today, and developers in the city want to kick people out, whether that's through luxury towers or the tallest jail in the world. So when shopping around, when trying to find supporters for this jail project, the city shopped around for supporters, and the Museum of Chinese in America said, "What's your price?" The city gave them $35 million to support building this jail project, and then city tells everyone, "Oh, MoCA supports the jail project. That means Chinatown supports the jail. We'll put the jail there." MoCA announced their own plans. They're going to buy a building, make a fancy museum for themselves. Meanwhile, the community gets a jail. They tell everybody, "We're good guys. We're just a innocent museum." Meanwhile, they're contributing to the displacement in Chinatown. The chair of the board of the Museum of Chinese in America is Jonathan Chu. He's the largest landlord in Chinatown. He evicted the original location of Jing Fong, the largest restaurant in the area, a big driver of jobs, big driver of a big community center in that area. Everyone's talking about saving Chinatown in the middle of COVID. Meanwhile, Jonathan Chu evicted the largest restaurant, a big driver of the community, telling everybody, "I'm a good guy. I run the museum for the community." So we see at all these each of these moments, the city's attempt to destroy Chinatown and Lower East Side isn't possible without these sellouts like MoCA, like Jonathan Chu. So the Jing Fong workers and young people with Youth Against Displacement, we've been picketing outside the Museum of Chinese in America for over a year. And MoCA has responded by calling the police on us and issuing tickets to us. In fact, one of the detectives in the Fifth Precinct in Chinatown, Vinny Chung, is friends with Jonathan Chu. And the first tickets that were issued to us, Vinny Chung issued to two Jing Fong workers, Chinese immigrants, because he thinks that, oh, they don't speak English. They are just lowly workers. They're easy pushovers. I'll give them a ticket. They'll go away. After following on that, issued tickets to six more young people, criminalizing us, trying to set the story that actually it's these are the bad guys here. These are the criminals. In fact, the story for the jail project is they'll make it easier for people to visit their inmates. So what are they saying? That all of Chinatown is full of criminals? And this is really one of the another avenue. What the MoCA, what NYPD have done is racist. And what they're doing now with the criminalization of young people, the criminalization of the workers protesting, the displacement and the racism, they're also criminals. And that's why it's okay for us to put this jail here. That's the story they're trying to tell. Mm. I also want to mention that they did the same tactic in 2018. In the middle of winter, the NYPD evicted residents at 83, 85 Bowery. This is around like 30 families in the middle of winter using the police. What are they trying to say? Oh, they're just, don't worry about them. They're just cheap lives. We can evict them when a developer wants to come back and redevelop the building and make a fancy luxury building for himself. But these people fought back. They got back. They got back their home, and they got back even more. And I have to leave soon, so I want to mention on December 17th, there will also be a big mobilization outside the Museum of Chinese America to protest the displacement and racism that the museum has been doing.
And Gary, what time is that, and where is the MoCA, where is the Museum of Chinese American?
It's at 215 Center Street near the Canal Street Station at 11.
Well, I thank you. And by the way, you should know that your colleague is going to take over from you. Yolanda Zhang is going to join us in a moment. I'm sorry that you can't stay longer. Gary, he is with Youth Against Displacement. We wanted to give him an opportunity to add another dimension to the discussion, and we're going to pick up with his colleague, Yolanda Zhang, in a moment. But since Gary has mentioned that, I want to bring in another dimension, and that is, of course, the issue of policing. There are people who feel that they are benevolent, that they are concerned about the population on the street. And so, therefore, there isn't housing right now. And what you do is you cuff them up and you lock them up. You put them in the hospitals. And the issue is not, for me, whether or not there are enough hospital beds or not. The issue is, really, this is the solution, turning the page again over from Rudy Giuliani. Once again, that failed policy, that inhumane policy. And I should say that I personally believe that there are a lot of legal issues about whether or not we have the right to make a determination about who gets to stay in a public space. And the issue of cuffing them and locking them up, that seems to be the mechanism for dealing with some population of homelessness. So I want to go back to Rob, and I want to go back to Tom and Michael, their thoughts on this and some of the things that Gary was saying. And of course, letting our listeners know that we raise these issues, we raise them in the context to what do we do to organize, and what do we do about the crisis of housing that is really across the country at this juncture. So I want to take it back to Rob to respond to some of the things Gary was saying and just the element that I've raised.
So you bring some interesting thoughts to my mind. I mean, I struggle, and I'm going to be very open and honest with your audience. As somebody who fights for the right to housing, and within international legal frameworks, I'd fight for that right. I've often been criticized by fellow activists because I don't believe in allowing people to stay in the streets. I don't believe you can survive the streets of New York City and the change in climate on a regular basis. It's going to beat you down. I lived on the streets of Miami where people perceive that that's a safe place, it's warm, no, that sun wore me out. I can't do it. That sun is going to kill me. So I there's a part of me internally that struggles. But I want to be clear here. I don't believe in just invading people's rights and pulling them off the streets and putting them in hospitals. That's not the solution either. I believe in a housing first model, which is a prevailing model around the world, which says bring people off the streets, give them housing, and surround them with the necessary support services that they need. I think that's the approach that we need to take. So it's complicated for me. I'll be very honest, right? Because sometimes I feel like I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth. If I say you have the human right to a home, but then people say, can you support the Stop the Sweeps campaign? We don't want people swept off the streets. Well, I don't want people swept off the streets either, but I do want people housed. So it becomes a complicated issue, and you know, navigating that space can sometimes be tricky and challenging. But I want to be clear here. I think this edict issued by the mayor is problematic at its core. And I don't think it's going to get off the ground. Maybe he announced it, and the backlash is overwhelming. You know, there's a protest on the steps of City Hall yesterday. There's going to be one today. So I think you're going to see a lot of outcry against this, right? You have to come up with a better plan. If you're going to pull people off the streets, then you need to house them, put them in the housing. That's what they need. They're on the streets because they're unhoused, they're homeless, right? But if you don't get at the root cause, then you're not going to solve the problem. The problem is people are homeless because they don't have a home. They need homes.
You know, I'm glad you also mentioned the protest that's going to be happening today is dealing with the issue of those who have been formally incarcerated and landlords being able to use criminal background checks and records to also deny people housing. So that's an entire issue in and of itself, and how counterproductive and socially destructive. Michael William, your thoughts, and then Tom certainly join in, and then we'll also move to our new guest who's joined us, who's been listening, Yolanda Zhang with Youth Against Displacement. And let me just re-announce that Michael Williams is a longtime advocate who deals most demonstratively with runaway and homeless youth and providing support, legal services, and so on. Rob Robinson is a co-founder and member of the leadership committee of the Take Back the Land movement and is currently an advisor at Partners for Dignity and Rights. And Tom Engotti is a progressive planner. City planner who's written books, actually dozens of books, but the two that I think are most important for people to read are Zoned Out, Race Displacement and City Planning in New York City, and New York for Sale, Community Planning Confronts Global Real Estate. So, Michael, Rob, Tom, Yolanda, it's great to have you with us. So, Michael, if you could pick up on some of the things that Rob was saying.
I would totally second the importance of services being made available to people who are homeless. So working at a multi-service agency that has a runaway and homeless youth department, part of what we're doing is making a breadth of services available to young people who are homeless. But part of what we're doing as well is that their door staff working at two supportive housing sites in Lower Manhattan, where young people are able to get permanent housing and also continue to get the supports that they need. And so the model that we are working or doing at the door involves getting services to young people while they're homeless, but also trying to identify resources so that they can be connected as soon as possible to permanent housing while at the same time developing their skills. But to make that type of model work, you have to have the supportive housing available at the other end. And if there's not enough funding, which has been the case historically, not enough funding for supportive housing, it makes it very, very challenging when we are working with young people who are homeless to find permanent housing solutions for them.
And Tom Engotti, you and I have been, and I want Rob to join in this too, we've been dealing with the issue of supporting housing in the public domain, which is not as well understood now and is perhaps less popular than when we were raising this more than 30 years ago. But so we've all identified the reality that there has to be housing that is not affordable. That's a misnomer. It's housing that is available to all. Shelter housing as a human right, that's one thing, legally as well as ideologically. And then two, the question of providing housing for the no income, for the low income, for the disabled, for all kinds of different categories, for people who have aged out of foster care, as Michael Williams was speaking about, for people who have are the formerly incarcerated, who have all kinds of restrictions on them in terms of finding housing, and people who are just poor. I think it was, as Rob said, there is more than 64,000 homeless families in the shelter system today, and they are overwhelmingly people who are working people, and they are the working poor. So the issue, of course, of jobs and income has everything to do with this. But Tom, take us through, and all of you, really, the reality that the root cause of the problem is, hey, we need housing, and we need no cost, low cost, no cost housing. We need housing essentially in the public domain and as a fundamental human right. Tom?
Well, yes, of course. Everything you said and others have said, I certainly agree with. And I would just take it to add something more, which is phenomenon of displacement is deeply embedded in the ideology and the politics of this nation. So it's not just that people don't have access to a roof over their head. People have been displaced. This is a nation of displaced people, particularly people from Africa, Latin America, Asia, who have come as working people and sought a better life, were able to get a low-paying job for the most part, and then had to struggle to find a place to live. And there's never been a guarantee that of any of this because of this mythology that if people don't have housing to get there, and they didn't work hard enough, and they came here, it's their responsibility. The nation has no responsibility. Certainly cities don't have a responsibility because there's nothing in state and federal law that guarantees a right to housing. I remember Rob and I think we're on a panel, I remember repeating the experience of the 1976 United Nations Habitat Conference in Istanbul. And there were a group of activists from all over the world and a group of activists from the United States who were lobbying for the UN declaration to guarantee, to say that a right to housing is a universal human right. There were two nations who opposed it. Yes, United States and Israel. And they oppose it on the basis that there's nothing in the Constitution, there's no legal basis for a right to housing. So it's, you know, it's really deeply, and how do you attract new immigration? You promise jobs, but then people immigrate and they find out, well, where am I going to live? You can't get an apartment unless you have a job, unless you have a clean record, and it's very difficult to stay. So Mindy Fullerlove has talked about this in her book. It's serial displacement. And the last of the, at the end of the road of displacement very often is living on the streets because there's no other place where you can get a roof over your head. And that's the other thing that's important in the international arena. Housing is not just a roof over your head. It's a right to a decent living. Even there are elements of U.S. law that say housing is not just a roof over your head. The Housing Act in the 1940s said it's right to housing in a decent living environment. And what does that mean? That means you get to stay in your community. You don't have to migrate again in order to get a roof over your head. But people should have the right to stay. And what we have in New York that's very deeply embedded is serial displacement of people. You get to get to build a neighborhood, build relations in a neighborhood, and fight against redlining, able to buy a house finally. And then all of a sudden, they find that the land in their neighborhood is worth 10 times more than the house, and the speculators are there knocking on their door, offering them crumbs in order to move out, and they buy the house. They get the neighborhood rezoned so that the real estate people can build more housing and make more money.
Well, I want to bring Rob back into this discussion since you and Tom have been on many panels together. Pick up what Tom was saying, Rob, and you've been all over the world looking at this issue. And as I announced to begin with, you are a member of the leadership committee of the Take Back the Land movement. Where does that fit into the process of creating housing and good gracious, operating in a society, in a context, and a social economic system, capitalism, that says housing is for profits. It's not for human rights.
So the Take Back the Land work all emanated from the financial crisis and foreclosure crisis of 2008, when we saw a large number of people losing their homes as Bank of America took over the mortgage portfolio of Countrywide Bank, and then the Obama administration turned around and took our tax money to bail out the banks, sending a strong message to the people. You can fail, people, but the banks can't fail. So we're going to bail out the banks. And then those banks, once they got our tax money, started foreclosing and evicting us in record numbers. And our response, particularly from the African-American community, is you can't have the tax money in the houses, too. So we're going to take back the houses. So folks that were evicted, foreclosed and evicted, we would find those houses, we would break in them, and move the families back in there and defend their rights to be in there using international human rights language and law. And I think that's where a lot of my work has elevated from that point on. I think Tom brings up this whole idea of displacement, but what Tom has done is gone back in history, which I appreciate. I was just in Barcelona 2 weeks ago speaking on evictions in Barcelona at an international human rights conference. And one of the things I brought to the attention of the people is the U.S. Constitution that starts off with the line, we the people. Well, who are those people? African Americans, people who were brought here from Africa, were not considered people. We were three-fifths of a person. So we weren't part of that decision-making in that Constitution. So I think it's problematic from the time that this country was created and displaced the indigenous people that were here. And then putting the value of property over people, it is fundamentally flawed. And that's where our problem started some close to 300 years ago and continue today. Article number 25 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights guarantees the right to a home, dignified, affordable, clean place to live. And it also guarantees economic stability in the event that people are unemployed, you know, other livelihoods or responsibilities that are under that are not under their control. So government has an obligation. That's the bottom line. And we're not living up to that obligation in this country. We're failing the people. Mm.
And we want to bring Yolanda Zhang in, who's been patiently waiting after Gary He left. And she is with Youth Against Displacement. And your interest and your thoughts about the work that you are doing in Chinatown as it relates to this discussion on, hey, I would say, let's call it housing the homeless.
Right, right. Yeah, thank you for having me, everyone. So definitely, I myself is Chinese American, living in Chinatown in a subdivided tenement because my sublandlord cannot afford a hiking rent every year. So I really think it's necessary, right, to call out the racist component in displacement. Otherwise, it'll continue to happen, you know, and we'll continue to be driven by profit, right? So I want to say that, you know, our organizing is focusing on the idea of fighting racism by fighting the developers' interests that often racially target us, you know, make us homeless, displaced. And, you know, that also oftentimes, you know, the real estate interests also adopt a minority facade to bamboozle all of us, right? So Gary talks about MoCA. Actually, MoCA selling out the community to the world's tallest jail, it's not just a local lesson. But to me, it reflects like a larger trend of racism, widespread, right? I found out recently that my former NYU professor, Rebecca Carl, who, you know, supposedly leftist, and the leading immigration historian, May Nye, at Columbia, like, you know, supposedly leftist, they both signed on to this petition that actually defends Jonathan Chu's cultural institution, MoCA. And Jonathan Chu is the largest landlord in Chinatown, the chairman of East Bank, you know, which is a Chinatown owned, you know, the bank owns and controls a substantial portion of real estate in Chinatown, right? So the petition, while paying lip service against the new jail, it actually, you know, tries hard to cheapen the lives of who still live and work and commute to Chinatown, right? By saying that actually, well, Chinatown cannot be saved, you know, so let's just keep the museum. Folks who still live here, their lives don't matter. So let's just keep the museum to commemorate the Chinese American culture that will be dead, right? So it's very dark. Actually, very racist way to say, yeah, the Chinese must go, you know. Actually, it's a life and death matter of so many people like me, so many people who still commute from all five boroughs to come work at Chinatown, right, because they're Chinese speaking and because, you know, they're immigrants like my parents' age or my grandparents' age. And it's a place for, you know, our people to really gather. You know, the former Jing Feng Dim Sum Hall was displaced by Jonathan Chu, you know, MoCA's co-chair. And the Dim Sum Hall is really like a place that, like, kind of gather the whole community, not just the Chinese, also, you know, Latinx folks, you know, from the Lower East Side. And, you know, it hosts like a thousand guests at the same time, you know, but it definitely was racially displaced during the middle of the pandemic, right, by Jonathan Chu and the MoCA Museum. And so it's really saying that, hey, generations of Chinese built Chinatown's economy to what it is today, and now the land values go up, right? We don't need them anymore. We can even dump the jail in Chinatown and make the Chinatown all run down. You know, the small business can't survive. And, you know, to drive the Chinese out to the Bronx, Brooklyn, or Queens, right? And we, you know, as the realty developers, I can say, you know, or, you know, say that I'm a realty developer, I can say that I need a group of academic and cultural elites to mask, you know, our developers' real motive, right, by writing up this very pessimistic sounding, actually very racist, you know, petition that, again, cheapens our life, right? So I really think that, you know, all the cultural and academic elites who sign on the letter, right, who support MoCA, you know, the sellout of our community, should really consider signing down.
And MoCA, right? Again, and is the Museum of Chinese Americans?
Chinese in America, yes. So it's, again, it's very confusing. It's duping all of us, right? It's real estate interests masked by this minority base. And, you know, so this rhetoric is very widespread. Like, you know, we had a lot of protests and marches, and none of my former professors attended them, right? So I really encourage everyone to get out on the street and really see, you know, gym phone workers and workers of all trades, residents, tenants in Chinatown who gather actually weekly in front of MoCA, and to say that, hey, actually this jail, the world's tallest jail, would not have happened without MoCA selling out of our community. You know, MoCA actually really fought in this meeting with former Mayor de Blasio to say that, hey, you know, we're willing to support a jail, how much you're going to give us. Right, it actually fought very hard to place its own interests, the real estate interests, right, over the community. So, you know, again, if it happens to Chinese, of course, you know, happens to Black and Brown folks all the time. Also, you know, in Lower East Side, Harlem, I think previously there's a museum / affordable housing / you know, luxury development being built in Harlem by Al Sharpton. You know, and across the city, we see the same trend. So we're all cheapened and criminalized, right? Within and without the thin walls of the jailscraper that's going to be built. So, and we are fighting back, and we call on, you know, folks to join us. Like Gary said, on December 17th, it's a Saturday, Saturday morning, 11 a.m. on 115 Center Street. You know, all workers of all trades, you know, are going to be protesting MoCA to say that, hey, enough of it destroying our life wave. This is our community. Right, enough of racist and violent displacement.
Well, thank you for that, Yolanda Zhang, Youth Against Displacement. And we'll be there. We'll be there. We have very limited time, but this is just the prelude, really, to an ongoing series of discussions that we have to have with all of you, Tom and Gotti and Michael Williams and Rob Robinson and Yolanda Zhang and Gary. To really deal with the issue of housing as a human right, and I believe housing in the public domain. But Rob, you kind of were the starting point for this discussion, and in the limited time, perhaps we could maybe we'll have room for a go around. But Rob, I want you to kind of take us out with some of your last thoughts, and maybe we can have some room for Michael Williams and Tom and Gotti then as well.
I'm going to be very brief, and following Yolanda, I'm going to say this: the only social change we've ever achieved in this country has come as a result of direct action or civil disobedience. So I'm a believer in taking it to the streets. That's how we get the attention of people in power, and that's how we make social change.
And the agenda that we're taking it to the streets in terms of housing, Rob?
I think we need housing for people who are unable to meet the prices that the market currently asks for. So we have to have housing that isn't subject to market pricing, right? I think you mentioned it earlier. There were some people with no income. How do we house them? They deserve decent housing. They're humans, right? So we have to figure this out. We've been able to put a rocket ship on the moon and take pictures of the moon. I think we can figure out this problem. It's just about the political will.
Yeah, and I think the jails, they're talking about the jail scrapers, roughly about $85 billion that is going to be put into that. So we're still, that's the way we deal with social issues, the carceral
Absolutely.
State. Down with jails, up with housing. Michael Williams, your last thought, and then Tom and Gotti.
Yeah, I think we are clear that we're focusing not just on shelter, but housing. And part of housing as a right is including a right to permanent housing. So that means protections against displacement. That means protections against evictions when a person is paying the rent and living up to all the conditions of their tenancy. They need to be protected. The young people that I work with at the door are far, far away from ever owning their own housing, so they have to be able to rely on and access permanent housing so that they're able to go on with their lives and accomplish their dreams.
And I must just add that we also have to make sure that Albany finally passes. There has to be good cause evictions, people who live in non-rent stabilized. Yeah, people who live in housing that is less than six units can't and mustn't be evicted in a profit-making situation just
Hello.
At the whim of the landlord, if you will. Tom and Gotti, how are we going to get that housing?
Okay, well, quickly, I would just add to what's been said. There's one element
And you're going to do this in 1 minute, my friend.
Okay. That was suggested. Community is part of this. So we're a city of neighborhoods and communities where people have ties with one another, and they've been built up like Chinatown. But the real estate and government strategy is always to essentialize the community. The vision of for Chinatown by big real estate going back 50, 60 years was turn it into a little historic tourist destination, just like Little Italy, which doesn't have any Italians, and East Harlem, which is quickly being transformed from a Latino neighborhood to something else, a high income. And so we got to save neighborhoods, and people need to organize. Organizing is essential for anything, because don't expect government to change the laws unless we organize. And people organize at the grassroots, at the community level, at the city and statewide level.
You know what? You're also vibrant and full of knowledge and enthusiasm and passion. I'm going to make sure I'm telling management right now at WBAI, we need a housing panel. I think we should do it live and do it by broadcast, maybe for 3-4 hours, to really flesh out these ideas entirely. Gary, he who was with us with Youth Against Displacement, the wonderful Yolanda Zhang with Youth Against Displacement, and we'll see you at the Chinatown.